Okay, Apologetics 2, lecture number 9. We're going to be talking about Gordon Clark. And I hope I remembered my Gordon Clark notebook. Yeah, I got it here. Like, I have some quotes that I'd like to refer to as we go on about Gordon Clark. Remember that Cornelius Van Til, we're talking about three different presuppositionalists. And one is Cornelius Van Til. We said that the type of apologetic methodology that he used was transcendental presuppositionalism, where he used the transcendental argument that even to reason you have to assume the existence of the God of the Bible, even to argue against his existence. And now we're going to be talking about Gordon Clark, who his apologetic methodology I've titled Dogmatic Presuppositionalism. Some of the apologetic works of Clark, they're all published by the Trinity Foundation, which was an organization founded for the sole purpose of publishing this guy's works. Three Types of Religious Philosophy is one of his works. Clark Speaks from the Grave, which was written right before he died but published right after he died. An Introduction to Christian Philosophy. Religion, Reason, and Revelation. A Christian View of Men and Things. That's a fantastic book right there. And then his History of Philosophy, Daly's to Dewey. Point number one in the dogmatic presuppositionalism of Gordon Clark, he rejected traditional apologetics, the idea that you can start on some type of neutral ground and build one brick at a time and argue for different aspects of the truth of Christianity. He rejected traditional apologetics. He said that unaided human reason cannot arrive at truths about God. Okay? In other words, if you're going to arrive at truths about God, God's got to start the process, and that's because of his five-point Calvinism that he held to that. Now, he also, there were a lot of reasons why he did not like traditional apologetics. Some of them were for the same reasons that he rejected empiricism and rationalism and some of the other things that we're going to look at. But he even argued that even if they were successful, even if Aquinas proved the existence of an unmoved mover, that's still so far away from the God of the Bible that it's not the same being as the God of the Bible. Now, again, though, from a traditional standpoint, if you prove the existence of an unmoved mover or an uncaused cause, you've just begun the task. Then you're going to argue for this attribute, that attribute. You're building a case like that. It seems to me like Clark is acting as, because Clark presupposes the Christian God with all his attributes at the outset, it seems like Clark is demanding that the traditional apologist prove the Christian God with all his attributes at the outset, which is not what the traditional apologist is even in the business of doing. So I really don't think that he's got a devastating argument there. But Gordon Clark rejected, point number two, he rejected empiricism. Remember, empiricism is the idea that all truth is found through the five senses. Yeah, Jeff.
I was going to ask a question about Calvinist anthropology. When a person becomes saved through anthropology, does it change, is some sort of change in reason, right? And you know, I can use propositional language to rationalize the world?
Not really. There is a tremendous change that overcomes you. You receive a new nature, and then because of that, you freely accept Christ as Savior, because regeneration precedes faith in their thought. But that still doesn't mean that you can reason to God. Otherwise, they would begin to do that. So in other words, you still have to, in some way, presuppose God.
Well, the Bible uses logical language.
Yeah. Maybe I misunderstood your question. I thought your question was coming from the standpoint, could you use your reason to prove God's existence? The presuppositionists would say no. But Gordon Clark and Van Til would say that you could even reason with non-believers, though you couldn't. The guy's not going to accept Christ unless God regenerates him first. But they would still say that you could reason with non-believers. Now, Van Til and Clark would have a big argument about what exactly is going on there. Are we just reasoning because humans have to reason? That's what Van Til would say. Or are we reasoning because that's the only true way of thinking, because reason flows from the nature of God, for God is logic. And so there's a difference of opinion there. But the idea that truth can be found only through the five senses, empiricism, Clark rejected that. Not only did he reject, now we would reject it, the idea that all truth could be found through the five senses, obviously that's contradictory. Clark would argue that no truth could be found through the five senses alone, okay? Clark would argue along these lines. He would say that rational conclusions cannot be drawn from sense experience alone. Now, I would agree with that, that we've got to have some innate ideas before we go into our sense experience to determine that these two tape recorders are of equal size. I go into that sense experience with a prior idea of equality. And with that idea of equality, I make a rational judgment on what I'm the objects of my sense experience. I don't get my idea of equality from that. In other words, to make it oversimplification, we have an idea of the universals before we examine the particulars. Otherwise, we wouldn't be able to classify a particular as part of this universal set. Okay? And so what he's basically saying, it's like, he made a point, I think he said something along the lines that, see, Aquinas, you start out life with a blank slate, so you have to, through sense experience, you arrive at rational conclusions that you draw from the sense data. But that's where Clark knocked me out of my pure Thomism by showing that, by basically stating that from a mound of dirt, there's no way you can ever pull moral values out of that. You may not be conscious of it, but you come into the world with innate ideas of what is right, what is wrong, written on your conscience, that type of thing. But empiricism, you can't draw rational conclusions from sense experience alone. Clark also denied the basic reliability of sense perception. This is to the extreme that Clark went. When he gave a lecture at Dallas Theological Seminary, one of Geisler's students said, "If you don't trust sense experience, then how do you know that the biblical truth that you're presupposing is really biblical truth? Because how do you know that there's a Bible in your hand?" And so the student said, how can you know that there's a Bible in my hand? And Clark's response was, "What Bible?" Okay? Now, from my reading of Clark, I don't really think that Clark was denying that the guy was holding the Bible. I think what Clark was denying was that there's no way, in his understanding, for man to prove that. Okay? Clark, because of his views, was accused of being an idealist, was accused of believing that only ideas exist, and everything else is an illusion. And Clark said, "No, I'm not an idealist." But he said, "You misunderstand me. You thought I was writing metaphysically, i.e., things as they are, the study of being." And he said, "All I ever wrote about was epistemology, how we can know." So Clark never even really gets to the point, is there really a Bible in the guy's hands? He's always stuck in the mode that, hey, we've never secular philosophers and Christian philosophers who use secular philosophy have never been able to prove that there's a Bible in that hand. There's always a chance that you could be wrong. There's always a chance that, you know, we all were convinced somebody was trying to kill us, and then we woke up in a cold sweat and realized it was only a dream. And so there's always the possibility you're going to wake up in an invisible world and find out you were just dreaming that there was a physical world, and that in actuality you're the only one who exists. This sounds real weird to us, but I am a traditional apologist. I accept probabilistic arguments. I accept induction. In other words, I accept arguments which have conclusions that have a high degree of probability but are not true with logical necessity. Not so with Clark. He only accepts deduction. In fact, on that point I put down that he considers induction a fallacy. To say that Socrates is a man, Socrates is mortal, therefore all men are mortal, or even a better inductive argument, to say that every man who ever lived, every man who was ever born before 1850 has died, therefore every man born after 1850 will die. That's a pretty strong inductive argument, but Clark would argue you really haven't proved anything. Just because every man born before 1850 has died doesn't mean that all the men born after 1850 are going to die. And I would accept induction. We inductively make lots of decisions. There was no way to deductively prove that the chair that you're sitting on was going to be able to support your weight. But through induction, we conclude that man has the technology and the ability to build these things called chairs that do hold our weight. Okay? Who, Clark?
Yeah.
He thought it was invalid. One of his main objections against it was probably the two most famous proponents of it were Spinoza and Anselm. Yet Anselm claimed that he was proving with logical necessity the existence of the God of the Bible. Spinoza was claiming he was proving with logical necessity the God of pantheism. So that's one of Clark's points. How could it prove the existence of the God of the Bible when some guys who say it's valid and look at what it proves? It proves this God. Others are saying, well, it's valid, but it proves a different God. And in actuality, Clark, his dogmatic... He dogmatically presupposes the existence of the God of the Bible. He says you got to start somewhere, and everywhere else we start, we end up with contradictions. But if you dogmatically just presuppose the existence of the God of the Bible, lo and behold, life makes sense. I think that's a good argument, but I don't think that's the only argument, and that's what Clark is arguing. This is the only, just like Van Til, his transcendental argument is the only argument. There are no other arguments. And so I think Clark's got a good argument. I think Van Til's got a good argument. But when they go around saying my argument is the only one that's out there, I'm glad it's not the only one that's out there, because it has some strong points, but it has some weak points. For instance, Clark, one of Clark's, we're getting way ahead of ourselves, but one of Clark's weak points is if he doesn't like probability arguments, the only way you can prove, if Christianity is the only view that's totally consistent, and if Christianity is the only view that gives meaning to life, and all other views are inconsistent and they don't give life meaning or purpose, they don't explain human reason, they don't explain moral judgments that we make, then you'll never have, if Clark is right there, you're never going to have that deductive certainty, that argument that's going to prove his conclusion with certainty, because every argument up to the year 2000, and every non-Christian worldview contradicts itself, even if you could prove that, that doesn't say that somebody's going to, that says nothing about the possibility of somebody in the year 2001 coming up with a non-Christian worldview that is not contradictory and does make meaning, give life meaning and make sense of reason and morality. So, and by the way, Gordon Lewis in the book, that's the final objection that he makes to Gordon Clark. And I think, so Gordon Clark's basic view is, just think of Gordon Clark standing in the forest of worldviews. And he did something better than anybody else did. He took an axe to everybody else's worldview until he leveled every other tree in that forest except for the tree of the Christian worldview. And then somebody said, well, how do you know Christianity's true? He smiled and he grinned and he'd say, mine's the only tree left standing, ain't it? And that's his whole apologetic, is destroying everybody else, and then his is the only one left standing. And then when you try to test his, lo and behold, you find out that it is reasonable. But the problem is, it's always possible that some other tree is going to grow somewhere else, and it's not going to be contradictory. There's no way to prove it with logical necessity, which means his argument is just another argument with a high degree of probability. So he slams Aquinas. Well, his only has a high degree of probability, doesn't have logical necessity. Well, Mr. Gordon Clark, neither does yours. Yeah.
Well, as I said, you know, how can he presuppose something that is considered consistent, but he says that he can't, through reason, know anything true about God? It seems like it's, no, he's not saying through reason you can't know anything true about God, but through reason you can't prove God, is what he's saying. You got to presuppose God.
So no, Clark uses reason a lot, but we'll get to that in point three. We've already talked about why he rejected empiricism, okay? You know, in the basic reliability of sense perception, you see an oasis and it turns out not to be true. Clark's saying, hey, that's not very reliable. If you were fooled once through your sense perception, you could be fooled again. But he also rejected pure rationalism, because he said that reason cannot prove everything, because if it could prove everything, it would have to be able to prove its own first principles, like the law of non-contradiction, A cannot equal non-A at the same time in the same way, the law of identity, A equals A, the law of excluded middle, is something either is or it's not, in other words, it's either being or non-being, you know, that type of thing. He says that it can't prove those, because if it could prove those, then you'd have principles before that. But then they would have to be proven. You'd have an infinite regress, and you would prove absolutely nothing. So what he's arguing, and he's right here, something must be presupposed. Our thinking's got to start. So he says, well, why don't we just presuppose the Bible? Well, why don't we just presuppose the first principles of Aquinas? Because if you presuppose the first principles of Aquinas, most non-believers might disagree with you, but just by their disagreeing with you, they're presupposing the same first principles that Aquinas was presupposing. Okay? Just to communicate, just to think, you have to presuppose those first principles that Aquinas started with. And so why not start there? And I think that you'd get agreement from a non-believer earlier than you would, I mean, you have to be a believer before you'll agree with Clark's presupposition. You can still be a non-believer and agree with Thomistic first principles. Yet, if they agree to those first principles, and if you really stick to them and slam them every time they contradict those first principles, you ain't going to lose a debate. Every one of my first principles, I put it in, when I debated Dr. Peter John, I put it in a situation where if he wanted to attack any one of those premises, he would have to give up, any one of those premises, he would have to give up evolution and all of modern science. And he saw that, he recognized that, so he just decided, I'm not gonna touch his premises. Well, the problem is, if the conclusion follows from the premises, and you don't mess with the guy's premises, then the guy gets his conclusion. In other words, the guy wins the debate. And he pretty much admitted that right after the opening statement that he was just going to concede the debate and just stay up there and shoot off the hip for the rest of the evening. So Clark also rejected rationalism. Something has to be presupposed. In other words, before you can start your argument, Before you can go premise number one, premise number two, therefore this conclusion, before you can do that, you have to know premise number one. The problem is, to have that first premise, you have to presuppose it, because if there's evidence for it, then it's really not your first premise. And if there's evidence for that one, then it's really not your first premise. But if you do get a premise that you just pull out, and you don't back it with anything else, then that's your presupposition. Now, I would argue, and this is where Schaefer goes with it, Schaefer takes a step further and says, yeah, let's presuppose the existence of the God of the Bible. At the same time, we can put our presuppositions to the test. So whereas Clark looks for confirmation later on, but he's already presupposed the worldview and stuff like that, Schaefer does it a lot quicker and says, let's take my presupposition and your presupposition and let's put it to the test right away and see if we can verify which one handles all the available evidence. But the thing is that Schaefer has moved presuppositionalism. He wasn't the first. Carnell was the first to do it. He moved presuppositionalism so close to traditional apologetics that I view Schaefer's verification of presuppositionalism as one of the better forms of traditional apologetics. But we'll get to that. But we can see there were good reasons why Clark rejected empiricism and rationalism. What he's basically saying, this is a point I think that's real well taken from Clark. When man starts with himself and reasons just from himself and denies God's existence, the non-Christian philosopher, okay, what it comes out to is you're just left. If the true God of the Bible doesn't exist, who is guaranteeing that our senses aren't deceiving us, who's guaranteeing the existence of the external world and guaranteeing that an evil demon didn't create this world so that we would look at falsehoods and think they were true and look at the truth and think it was false. Without the God of the Bible, you're pretty much left with Kant's dilemma. Immanuel Kant, we can know reality as it appears to us, but we can never know reality as it is. There's always the possibility that we're wrong. Now, having said that human knowledge stands on shaky ground, I think we can say things that J.P. Moreland, a traditional apologist, has said. And that is, sometimes we know something, we just can't prove it. Okay? And that's where human knowledge, God created our minds in such a way that we know things about reality, but our minds are so limited that we can't always prove it with the logical necessity that Clark is demanding of everybody else, but seems to omit for himself.
Would you say that the basic reliability of sense that is supposed to take for granted is fit in that category? I know that I can't prove it.
Yeah. There's, and you know, we've been wrong before, but something really tells us we're not wrong right now. And we can check it up again and check it up again and check it up again. But granted, the fact of the matter is, every one of those checks could be wrong. Every one of those checks could be within another dream. So in other words, the presuppositionals have shown us the need for a presupposition, the need for faith even before reasoning, okay? But the fact of the matter is, just to do modern science assumes that everything makes sense and there's order in the world. Well, without the God of the Bible, or at least a theistic God, there's no reason why we should assume that the world makes sense and that there is order. So in other words, you can give Clark and Van Til their point on that particular issue and still not have to be therefore a presuppositionalist, or at least a presuppositionist to the degree that they are. You could be more the Schaefer type, or even a little bit further than him, put you right in the traditional apologist camp. But Geisler takes these criticism of a traditional apologetics very seriously. And I think he just fine-tunes his Thomism, he fine-tunes his traditional apologetics, and has one of the finest, if not the finest, apologetic methodology today.
Do you see the presuppositionalists more consistent with Calvinism than the adversary of the soul?
Definitely, definitely. Because traditional apologetics, yeah, that's a very key point. Traditional apologetics assumes you can move a man's will and persuade him and move him towards Christianity. Calvinism really comes down and teaches, hey, there's no movement towards Christianity. You're either in or you're not. And if you're in, it's an act of God. And if you're not, it's just a normal act of the human will. So, though I really appreciate Sproul's traditional apologetics, and although he Gerstner, and Lindsley do at times misunderstand Van Til, though I appreciate their traditional apologetics, I think it's more inconsistent with a view more conducive to the human free will, that a man can freely accept or reject Christ.
You know that R.C. Sproul took classes under
Van Til?
Yeah.
And I wasn't even sure that he... I do know that... in fact, he went to Westminster, right? But Gerstner was his big student. I mean, Gerstner, probably half of his courses were under Van Til. But Frame and Bonson are recognized as the torchbearers for Van Til, and they show from Vantilian quotes that when you put what he said here and what he said there together, that he is not saying there's no common ground with non-believers. He's saying there's common ground, we're in the same universe, we have to live in God's universe, but there's no neutral ground. So though we're in the same universe, we have our biases, non-believers have their biases. And so a lot of times they, and then Romans 1, Clark was the one who said in Romans 1 it doesn't get through. Van Til though said that no, God's revelation through nature does get through, and all men deep down inside, even the atheist, knows that God exists, but he suppresses that truth. And so I think they make a few mistakes there. Bonson and Frame, I think, are the two leading representatives of Vantilian thought, although Frames made adaptions to Van Til's thought. He'll tell you where he changed it. Bonson just accepts Van Til hook, line, and sinker, although I think he argues for Van Til's position better than Van Til did. But, Clark also, if you can't find truth through the five senses, empiricism, and you can't find truth through reason, then, you know, and I think too, you know, the idea that we can find truth through any truth through five senses alone, you really can't. Something more than the five senses are at work when you do find truth through the five senses. It's not the five senses alone. And something more when you find truth through rationalism, something more than just rationalism is at work. Something's got to be presupposed. So I would agree with them, but I don't think that entails... I would then just turn to a Pascalian premise like the heart has its reasons, which reason knows nothing about. Okay, in other words, sometimes we just know things, but we can't rationally prove it. Okay? But anyway, so Clark says, well, then what about irrationalism? In other words, fideism, taking a leap of blind faith and believing things, just believing things, period, without any evidence, and believing that contradictory things can be true. So the law of non-contradiction is not necessarily valid. But Clark rightly argues that if we allow contradictions, all thought and communication becomes meaningless. If we say that there's A can equal non-A at the same time in the same way, that would be the same as saying, that would entail that if I say John is 5 years old, then that can mean the same thing as John is 200 years old. If I say Frank is alive, that can mean the same thing as Frank is dead. They can both be true. So irrationalism just leaves you in a world where all thought and communication is meaningless, so Clark rightly objects to that. Clark argues that unaided human reason results in skepticism. He argues from Hume, from Immanuel Kant, and from Hegel that all non-Christian philosophy, all that it's left us with, is all we know is that we don't know. That's what where the world says, hey, I don't believe in God, but I'm going to reason on my own, and I'm going to just try to gather knowledge on my own. The world ends up with nothing but skepticism. Clark's view, therefore, is what he calls dogmatism. In other words, we should dogmatically presuppose the existence of the triune God and the truth of the Bible, the Bible as his inspired word. Now, if you ask him, well, why should we presuppose that? He would pretty much say, why not? I mean, everything else we've tried to presuppose and fail, why not just presuppose this? And then he points out, don't forget, point number 7, everybody must presuppose something. So you're going to slam me and say, well, you just, by a leap of blind faith, presuppose the existence of your God. And he says, well, if I talk with you for 10 minutes, I'll be able to tell you what you accept by blind faith, because you've got to presuppose something. Thought's got to start somewhere. You've got to presuppose something. So why tell me I can't have a starting point when you have to have a starting point too? Oh, and by the way, from your starting point, I can show you that it results in contradictions. Mine doesn't. Oh, and by the way, if your starting point is correct, you can't make sense out of life. There's no meaning to life. There's no sense in human reason. But in my worldview, there is.
Is Clark and Van Til, did they argue about that? Because Van Til said that God is above the law.
Yeah, big time. That and a lot of things. In fact, I think Gordon Clark was either about to get ordained or was ordained through a Presbyterian ministry and denomination that Van Til was part of, and Van Til had a big fight and got that shut down. And then he even got Van Til pretty much, I think Clark resigned, but he pretty much got it to the point where if he didn't resign, he was going to get kicked out of Westminster. When they were both at Westminster, they were at each other's throats. I mean, forget the traditional apologists. They were too busy slamming each other in the head to even bother banging it out with many traditional apologists. I think Clark was a much better philosopher than Van Til. Although I like Van Til's system a lot better, but Clark's the kind of guy, you cannot like his system, but good luck if you're going to try to refute it, because the guy is sharp. Point number 8, Clark would argue that since rationalism and empiricism have failed to make life meaningful, we should presuppose the truth of Christianity. Now, Clark's response to Immanuel Kant, that Kant's dilemma, is that we can know reality as it appears to us, but not reality as it is. His response to Kant is basically this, and I'm quoting from his A Christian View of Men and Things. God has fashioned both the mind and the world so that they harmonize. God has fashioned both the mind and the world so that they harmonize. In other words, the innate ideas God has given us do correspond to reality. Okay? In other words, Kant's saying, hey, before we can think, okay, before we can even think and try to examine the external world, we have to have certain categories in our mind, certain innate ideas, such as space, time, causality. But then Kant says there's no ways to know if we're really finding that in the external world, or if we're just reading it into the external world. Clark is arguing, hey, God made both our mind and the world in such a way that they do harmonize. that the innate ideas God has given us do correspond to reality. In other words, but then you would think that Clark could tell the guy, well, how do you know I have a Bible in my hands? You would think Clark would say, because God made our minds in such a way that they harmonize, that the mind and the world, so that they harmonize, and so that I can know through my senses that I have a Bible in my hands. But that's not what Clark is not proving that. Clark is presupposing it. Okay, so I don't know if you really understand. So in other words, I think so. Clark would say no. You know, I'd say, the thing is too is some of Clark's responses in his debates sounded to me like he was lying through his teeth. But then to pin him down on it, everybody who tried to pin him down on it ended up getting put under bash real quick. Yeah.
Is Geisler ever debated on tape?
I don't think so. I know he had Gerstner at one of his classes before some of his students, and they discussed issues. But I don't think he debated Clark. Clark is very difficult. It's easy to do it. When a man is extremely well-read, he's very, like, for instance, if a guy would argue, okay, if you were arguing with him, it always sounds like Clark, you're putting Clark on the ropes. You argue, now wait a minute, Gordon, we both know there's a desk here that I'm resting my hands on. Clark would say, how do you know there's a desk there that you're resting your hands on? We don't know that. So it sounds like we're backing them in the corner. And as we go on and on, eventually the guy's going to say, look, I'm touching this desk, and when I knock on it, it's solid. And then Clark would say, oh, it's solid, huh? And he'd say, yeah. And then Clark would ask you, how many books in the past year have you read on physics? Because the more we learn about the universe in which we live, the less and less solid objects appear, because we find out there's more and more space between the molecules than we thought, and so what we call solid appears to us to be solid, but the closer we look at it, the less solid it appears to us. So it's almost at a point where when you call something solid, you're using common sense type science, but a laboratory science, solid almost equals non-solid. Okay, so, but the guy is so well read that anything that you've accepted as truth, he's read the experts in that field. It's like he told one guy, define what you mean by matter. I said, what do you mean? Everybody knows what I mean by matter. We all mean the same thing. He said, oh, do we? I read 7 different physicists this last year, and each one of them came up with a different definition of matter. The 3 leading definitions are, and he'd give the 3 leading ones. Say, which of them do you hold to? And then if you pick any one of those 3, he'll show you that from that definition, what you're saying still doesn't make sense. Okay? So, you know, We need God, and this is what the presuppositions is pointing out. But even given that, we can still do traditional apologetics. We need God for more than just salvation. Okay, even, you know, he talks about unaided human reason cannot arrive at truths about God. I don't think a traditional apologist is really acting like it's unaided human reason. I mean, even that reason that we have, God gave it to us, and what we're looking at is natural revelation, so which is God revealing himself to us through nature. So in its sense, what Clark calls unaided human reason isn't really unaided. Okay, but I think from the presuppositions we see that God, you know, it's like Paul said, in him we live and move and have our being. We're not just dependent on God for salvation. We're dependent on him for every breath of life that we have. for every time our heart beats, we're dependent on Him. For every microsecond of existence, we're dependent on Him, and for all our thinking, we're dependent on Him. At the same time, I don't think any of that means that we can't find common ground and argue in a manner that would differ from Clark or Van Til's argumentation. Point number 10, and so Clark, would, in his response to Kant, without presupposing God, you are left with Kant's dilemma. I think that's one of the strongest points that he makes, too, by the way. If we don't presuppose a God who has ordered this universe in such a way that through reason man can find out about things in the universe, we're left with only knowing reality as it appears to us, not reality as it is. And you basically need a God to bridge that major gap. You need the theistic God at the very least. Clark would then argue that when you look at his presupposition and all the other presuppositions, only his presupposition is self-consistent. In other words, it doesn't contradict the law of non-contradiction. It doesn't contradict itself, so it doesn't fall to the law of non-contradiction. Only Christianity is self-consistent and gives meaning to life and moral experience. Now, I think that's a great point, Clark. The only problem is you're starting to sound like a traditional apologist when you start doing that. He said, yeah, but I presuppose Christianity in the first place, and I'm not arguing to it. I'm confirming it after I presupposed it. Yeah, but I could turn the shoe on the other foot and say, yeah, but maybe Aquinas didn't realize it. But maybe Aquinas was presupposing the truth of Christianity and arguing from it and then finding confirmation for it rather than just wiping the slate clean and arguing to it like Descartes claimed to do. So, in the end, it's like Geisler. When I was talking to Geisler said, hey, when we were talking about presuppositions, Geisler said, look, everybody defends the faith. You presuppositionalists, even Phidias. Phidias will say you just have to take a leap of blind faith, then they'll share their testimony with you as evidence that Christianity is true because of the way Christ changed their lives. So it's not so much that there are actually Christians who are really consistently teaching that you cannot defend the faith, but what they end up saying is, my way to defend the faith is the only true way. And what the traditional apologists are saying is, no, there are many ways that we can prove the truth of Christianity with different degrees of probability. Point number 11 for Gordon Clark. Only Christianity supports the existence of truth and the possibility of knowledge. So if we don't presuppose Christianity, you can't really prove anything, even the concept of truth. Just because A equals A today doesn't mean that it's not going to equal non-A tomorrow. Just because torturing innocent babies is wrong today doesn't mean it's going to be wrong tomorrow unless God exists. By the way, when I spoke on God's existence at Olympic College and then a couple skeptic students challenged me after that in the question and answer period, I showed that first you couldn't get, if in a godless universe there's no such thing as right and wrong, and the other one says yes, because there is a moral law above all men because you can prove it through logic, through the laws of logic. Well, the problem is, what I then turned on him, I said, well, if there is no God, then even the laws of logic were invented by men. And so eventually I worked back the guys into a corner to where they admitted that if you lived in the South in the 1830s, slavery was right, but now slavery's wrong, which means 150 years from now, slavery might be right again. And they admitted that if their worldview is correct, if atheism is true, then slavery could be right again, enslaving blacks could be morally right again 150 years. And I basically told them, I said, that's not a very desirable worldview, and on that alone, I think Christianity is so far superior to the atheistic worldview, and I would hate to try to defend that position in front of 300 blacks, and I'm not even black, and that position disgusts me. But if I was black and this guy was telling me 150 years from now it might be right for for this white guy to put a whip to that black's back, I'd be disgusted with that worldview. And now, Clark, point number 12, used the law of non-contradiction. He called it the law of contradiction. But he was actually using the law of non-contradiction. I think the reason why he called it the law of contradiction was he didn't want to have anything in common with Aquinas. And since Aquinas presupposed the law of non-contradiction, he called it the law of contradiction. But he used the law of non-contradiction to refute non-Christian belief systems. I'm going to close this lecture right here.